virtue is indeed its own noblest reward. Silius Italicus. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week, especially after the, in my opinion, very rough episode last week. I was not happy having to re-record that, and I feel like it did hurt the product. Thankfully, I don't think I missed many important points, though there were a couple of things I thought I phrased better and made it more eloquent. I know that might be a surprise to some of you, but that was my opinion. That said, there are a couple of things I did miss on the re-recording. But before I get onto that, I just want to say at the outset of this episode that this week's primary topic is going to be covering some specific Sumerian creation myths, specifically those outlined in what is known as the Eridu Genesis. And we'll also be taking excerpts from some of the disputation literature that may have additional clues to acts of creation of certain things that the Sumerians believed. I doubt we'll have time to go over all of those disputation letters, but we might. We'll see. I might just read them and just kind of give the highlights, but we'll go over that. But first, though, I did want to go back and talk about what I missed on the re-recording. Oh, and of course, thank you all for joining me. If you're a new listener, welcome. Please feel free to go back and listen to our backlog of episodes. And of course, for all of our returning listeners, as always, thank you so, so much. In the second part of the king list that we covered last week, covering the kings of Kish after the flood, I believe I said at the outset that obviously most of the kings on the, well, actually technically the first two sections are believed to be completely mythical. And part of the reason for this is that their names are not found on the earliest inscriptions in some cities. Now, obviously, you have Etana and Dumuzi that were listed on very early inscriptions. Of course, those are the deified versions of those individuals, so we don't know, obviously, if they were real people who were deified, or if they were gods who they just said, oh, these at one point people were ruling these places. But the other kings on the king list are, you know, we have no record of them. However, for the kings of Kish specifically, at least all the ones before, or I think seven or eight of the ones before Etana, almost all of those are believed to have been pure myth and pure, like, after-the-fact additions. They were not real people. And the reason for this is that their names are Akkadian, not Sumerian. Now, and I suppose it is technically possible that there, you know, may have been a very small chance that there were some proto-Akkadian speakers in Sumer. But this would have been a very small amount, if at all, which again, it's not certain that there were, but they would have been there in such a small amount, there's very, very low chance that any of them would have been kings. To be a king in Sumer, we'll go into this later, but it requires a certain, you know, amount of connections if your father's not a king, and most of the kings at these early dates that we know for a fact were real, they have Sumerian names. Why would they not name their sons Sumerian names, if even indeed the person succeeding them is their son? There is some question, you know, how many of these kings are actually related to the previous king. Obviously, there's a good chance for that, but it's not always clear, and not all cities may have followed, you know, inheritance like that. So that is another thing to keep in mind. Now, in the future, there are definitely enough Akkadians to, you know, have a very, you know, powerful impact on Sumerian politics. And there are even kings who we know for a fact were at least half Sumerian, half Akkadian, or like a quarter Akkadian and part Sumerian. So, you know, that does happen later, but when that is happening, we have evidence of a sizable, you know, at least portion of of the Sumerian cities having Akkadian populations. But again, I guess it is possible that there were some either Eastern Semitic speakers or post-Akkadian speakers, but they don't show up in the archaeological evidence. And again, obviously you're not going to find much to differentiate them materially because they're living in Sumerian cities, they're living that lifestyle. But we do have, you know, private and public records from those earlier periods, though not always, you know, in a large amount, but none of them mention any Akkadian names. Now, there may have been Akkadian people who had been enslaved or who were, you know, visiting the markets in the Sumerian cities, and that definitely is something that happens in the later periods, we know for a fact. But again, at this earlier dates, it's very unlikely. So that is at least 7 of 8 of those kings we know for a fact to be just made up out of whole cloth. Whereas the Sumerian ones, most of them are likely fake, but there's always the chance that at least the names might be real and some aspects of them might have been remembered through long time storytelling. But, you know, make of that what you will. So, I think with that out of the way, we can go ahead and dive into our primary topic of discussion. And that is going to be, again, the Eridu Genesis. And I will be using translations from Livius.org and the Electronic Text Corpus of Sumerian Literature, like I did last week, for all the things I'm going to be reading from. So, you can always check those out, too. So yeah, let's go ahead and dive into that. The name for the Eridu Genesis obviously comes from the biblical Genesis, which is the Greek word that was used in the Greek translations of the first 10 books of the Old Testament. Genesis means origin, and of course that has spread to a lot of different languages, including English. So that word is used because, of course, the similarities between these two stories. Of course, the Sumerian version of the world flood is much older than the one found in the Old Testament, and you know, even later cultures that kind of neighbor and supplant the Sumerians, they all have their own version of the flood myth. But there are a couple of differences, or missing parts, I should say, from the Sumerian version that, of course, we do have in the Old Testament and other versions of this from, like, the Akkadians, the Babylonians, those types of civilizations as well. Now, the Eridu Genesis is written, of course, on cuneiform tablets. Unfortunately, about 2/3 of the story are lost. But we have been able to construct or reconstruct some parts of the text from other things, like the Sumerian king list and later authors kind of summarizing the stories. I think Berossus is one of those writers. And Berossus is a priest who wrote a history of Babylonia in Greek for the Seleucid monarchs during, I think, sometime between like the 1st and 3rd century. I forget the exact time, but we probably use some of his sources or some of his writings in later episodes as well. But he wrote a history of the entirety of Mesopotamia, or at least a good chunk of it, at least what he knew. So, this is kind of a summary of what can be found in this. There's the creation of men, which sadly is now lost. It's how crappy their condition was, how poor, why kingship was created, is to deal with that miserable condition. And of course, then you have the description of the creation of kingship. You have the first cities. You hear about the kings who ruled before the great flood. This part is lost, but again, we know at least from the king list who was at least some of those people that would probably have been mentioned in that story. We have Enlil's decision to destroy humanity. This is lost. Then we have Zeusudra learns of the calamity. We have him building his ark, though this is lost. We have the great flood itself. We have Zeusudra's sacrifice, and Zeusudra be given the chance to have an eternal life. Now, we do have later versions of these stories from other cultures, but again, it's their version. It's not necessarily the Sumerian version. So, just keep that in mind. And we'll go over some differences, obviously, between the versions that we do have at later dates. So, let me go ahead and get ready for this. I've got to take a drink real quick. Nintur was paying attention. And Nintur, again, is another name for Ninhursag. Her name has a couple of different written forms, but Nintur is probably an older version, and a diminutive as well. And again, she is most likely one of the wives of either Enlil or Enki. Usually it's Enlil, but there are some traditions that have her being a wife of Enki. Let me bethink myself of my humankind, all forgotten as they are, and mindful of mine, Nintur's creatures, let me bring them back. Let me lead the people back from their trails. Let they come and build cities and cult places, and I may cool myself in their shade. May they lay the bricks for the cult cities in pure spots. May they found places for divination in pure spots. She gave directions for purification and cries for clemency, the things that cool divine wrath. Perfected the divine service and the august offices, said to the surrounding regions, let me institute peace there. When An, Enlil, Enki, and Ninhursaga fashioned the dark-headed people, and the dark-headed people is what the Sumerians' name for themselves meant, they had made the small animals that came up from out of the earth, come from the earth in abundance, and had let there be as befits it, gazelles, wild donkeys, and four-footed beasts in the desert. And that is the first section. That is obviously the goddess of creation, imagining creating humankind. And I have read some more recent kind of discoveries of Sumerian writing, but I believe it does come after the Akkadian period, so it can't be 100% dated to this. But there is kind of a case where Ninhursag creates humanity. She creates all the different kinds of people you might run into. And Enlil tries his hand, but he's not as successful. And he asks for her help in kind of giving them life too. But she is the primary creator of humanity in this version of the story. And that makes sense. She's the goddess of childbirth. She's an earth goddess. She's a fertility being. So, makes sense. Now, once that section is over, there's a break, and then we are into the creation of kingship. Forgive me, had to get ready. And unfortunately, this does start mid-sentence. Excuse me. And let me have him advise. Let me have him oversee their labor. And let him teach the nation to follow like unerringly like cattle. When the royal scepter was coming down from heaven, the august crown and the royal throne being already down from heaven, the king regularly performed to perfection the august divine services and offices, and laid the bricks of those cities in pure spots. They were named by name in allotted half-bushel baskets. All right, so even at this early stage, we can see that certain aspects of kingship have already been invented for the Sumerians, and these are things that would, make a lot of sense to us, at least from our understanding some of the language around kings in the past. We have him, of course, being like a shepherd, minding his flock, in this case, cattle. He oversees work, labor. And he already has a throne, a crown. So these are aspects, and a scepter as well. So these are things that denote a king. A king should have all of these things. And, of course, he has a religious function as well. But he also has to make sure that new cities are laid out, or new portions of cities, as is more likely the case. And, of course, that everyone that has their name written down is allotted all of their rewards for their service. Notice there's no real talk of leading men into battle. That is not one of the, at least not one of the properly spelled out roles of a king. And we'll get into that later, of course, but it is interesting. Though, again, this is only 8 lines. There's stuff missing between the previous section, obviously, and this one. There could have been failed attempts. It could have been things like that. But now we will move on to the section concerning the first cities. The firstling of the cities, Eridu, she gave to the leader Nidimud. The second, Bad Tabira, she gave to the prince and the sacred one. The third, Larak, she gave to Pahilsag. The fourth, Sipar, she gave to the gallant Utu. The fifth, Surapak, she gave to Ansud. These cities, which had been named by names and had been allotted half-bushel baskets, dredged the canals, which were blocked with purplish, wind-borne clay, and they carried water. Their cleaning of the canals established abundant growth. And then there's a break where it lists the antediluvian kings. And then, you know, it talks about working in canals and fields. And all this work causes a lot of noise. So much so that the supreme god, Enlil, basically comes up with the plan to destroy humanity. And, you know, he talks presumably to the other gods about this. That day, Nintur wept over her creatures, and holy Inanna was full of grief over her people. But Enki took counsel with his own heart. An, Enlil, Enki, and Ninhursaga had the gods of heaven and earth swear by the names of An and Enlil. Now, do want to go over a couple of things laid out in those first couple of lines, where she gave this first cities. Eridu, she gave to the leader Nudimud. Now, this is the Sumerian word for creation, and creation, of course, is the one of the divine realms that Enlil has control over. So that is her saying that, you know, the city was given over to Enlil, and sometimes he is referred to as Nudimud. As for Bad Tabira, the prince is obviously Dumuzid, who was on the king's list there. Now, the sacred one's a little bit more debated. It could be Lulal, remember, who was kind of like the primary assistant to Inanna, kind of like her loyal servant. It could have been, there were some other temples we know were there that may have been more important earlier. Also, there was a goddess who was also worshipped. She was considered to be Dumuzid's sister, and I forget her name exactly, but I believe it was Geshtinana, and we'll talk about her, you know, when we do Ishtar's Descent into the Netherworld, but that's for next season. Larak, of course, being given to Pahilsag. This is a little bit more difficult. Pahilsag was a son of Ninlil and Nintur, who, of course, we have been discussing, but who was also Ninhursaga. Now, in other versions, they also have a son called Ninurta, who is also the son of Enlil and Ninhursag, and Ninurta actually, in one of the stories, renames Nintur to Ninhursag. So there may have been actually two gods that were very similar, and Ninurta just kind of won out in popularity. But in later periods, they may have been seen as the same person. We know that Pabilsag is a little bit more warrior focused, maybe, than Ninurta, who, though a very, capable war god, that was not his primary function. He was more known for as being the Lord of Barley. That's what his name possibly means. So maybe Pabilsag was kind of his war aspect, whereas Ninurta was the more agricultural, hunting aspect, the more leisurely, gentlemanly version of the god. But this is a good, example of how, again, different cities had different traditions about things, and how eventually one of those traditions, more often than not, won out. Utu being given Sipar, he, of course, was the sun god. He is the actual sun as well, or at least he drove the sun, depending on when the story is being told. And then finally, Surapak, she gave to Ansud. Now, this is actually an example of one of those translations kind of being a little wonky, at least early on. Because this, I believe, is the first translation of this set of myths that I'm reading. So, Ansud, of course, has An. But there, the goddess Sud, she was essentially the goddess of the ripened grain. And eventually, she kind of is absorbed into the identity of the goddess Ninlil, who is, of course, one of Enlil's other consorts. So, that's who that is. Now, I think that is it for the first cities. I don't think there's anything else I need to go over there. So let's go ahead and dive into the next session. And this involves Zeusudra's vision. So this is after the gods of heaven and earth swore by the names of An and Enlil. At that time, Zeusudra was king and lustration priest. He fashioned being a seer, the god of giddiness, and stood in awe beside it, wording his wishes humbly, as he stood there regularly day after day. Then there's a break. Something that was not a dream was appearing. Conversation, a swearing of oaths by heaven and earth, a touching of throats, and the gods bringing their thwarts up to Kiur. To simplify matters, basically, Zeusudra has a vision about the gods as they're discussing the fate of humans. And when they say touching of throats, this is kind of thought to be a gesture that indicate that if someone breaks their oath, he's basically saying to behead him, that he is going to allow himself to be beheaded. And the Kior is a part of the temple of Enlil in Nippur. So now we move on to the next section. And as Zeusudra stood there beside it, he went on hearing, "Step up to the wall, to my left, and listen. Let me speak a word to you at the wall, and may you grasp what I say. May you heed my advice. By our hand, a flood will sweep over the cities of half-bushel baskets and the country. The decision that mankind is to be destroyed has been made. A verdict, a command of the assembly, cannot be revoked." And then there's another break. "No order of An and Enlil is known to have been countermanded. Their kingship, their terms have been uprooted. They must bethink themselves. Now, what I have to say to you." And then we don't know exactly. Well, we do know exactly from later context. But essentially, this is Enki speaking to Zeusudra, giving him advice, and telling him to build the ark and load it with pairs of animals, a la, of course, the flood story related in the Old Testament. And this is now a section describing the flood. "All the evil winds, all stormy winds, gathered into one, and with them the flood was sweeping over the city of the half-bushel baskets for 7 days and 7 nights. after the flood had swept over the country, after the evil wind had tossed the big boat about on the great waters, the sun came out spreading light over heaven and earth. And then, of course, we have... actually, I think this actually rolls immediately into the next section, which is Zeusudra's sacrifice. Zeusudra then drilled an opening in the big boat, and the gallant Utu sent his light into the interior of the big boat. Zeusudra, being the king, stepped up before Utu, kissing the ground before him. The king was butchering oxen, was being lavish with the sheep, barley cakes, crescents together with... He was crumbling for him. Juniper, the pure plant of the mountain, he filled on the fire, and with a clasped to the breast he... So, there you go. So, the first thing that Zeusudra does after the storm is to offer sacrifice to the gods, especially to Utu, who's bringing forth these lights into the sun. I do think it's interesting, and I wonder if it was mentioned in the original text, but obviously sacrificing the animals you just saved, you would assume that he had more than just the one pair of cattle and sheep, but maybe it was just an oversight. After that, you have, of course, Enlil is very upset that humans survived. But Enki, from what we know, explains himself. And unfortunately, we only have the very end of Enki's speech. You here have sworn by the life's breath of heaven, the life's breath of earth, that he verily is allied with you yourself. You there, An and Enlil, have sworn by the life's breath of heaven, the life's breath of earth, that he is allies with all of you. He will disembark the small animals that come up from the earth. So, unfortunately, we're missing a lot of what Enki said. I would like very much to know what else was in his speech to convince Enlil to stay his wrath of Zeusudra, and of course to probably save his own head. Now, afterwards, you have the final section that we have. Zeusudra, being king, stepped up before An and Enlil, kissing the ground, and An and Enlil, after honoring him, were granting life like a god's. Were making lasting breath of life, like a god's descended into him. That day they made Zeusudra, preserver, as king, of the small animals and the seed of mankind, live toward the east over the mountains of Dilmun. And again, in the earliest tales, Dilmun's kind of like a paradise, or like a far-off land on the edge of the earth. And later it was kind of assumed to be somewhere around modern day Bahrain, because there were people living in that area and there's a lot of trade going on, but Bahrain, for whatever reason, matched kind of some of the descriptions or the theory of what Dilmun was. So of course they kind of like, oh well, that's where Dilmun is. So that's that one. Now, of course, as time goes on, I'm sure that story evolved. And we know for a fact it did, because we have later versions, including Akkadian, Babylonian, and of course the ancient Hebrew version, which of course got transmitted to both Christianity and Islam as well. Little interesting, and of course, obviously, those stories left a huge impact because they were popular. It did kind of, talk about how humanity was all wiped out, and the gods, did eventually forgive humanity. Though, of course, in this situation, Zeusudra was not meant to live by Enlil or An. He was protected by Enki, which is one of the reasons Enki was so popular with humans. But, of course, his godly nature, of course, kind of helped the next generation prevent that disaster with the gods again. At least, you would hope, permanently. Now, obviously, the version of the Hebrew Bible, it's a little bit more straightforward. There's other issues. It's not that humans are being allowed. There's a whole slew of other things for why God decides to kill everyone, but also why he chooses Noah to kind of continue the human race afterwards. But we'll, of course, cover all that in much greater detail later. Next, I want to go over the debate between winter and summer. This is another kind of creation story, dealing with creation of the world, I guess, more closely. Not quite as focused on humans, per se, but, you know, there is definitely wisdom in there for humans, of course, if they would hear it. You'll also sometimes see this called the debate between Imesh and Intin. Imesh is the personification or deification of summer, and Intin is the deification of winter. Now you may be saying, hey, where's spring and fall? Well, in Sumeria, or in Sumer, I should say, and then I guess even to an extent today in the region, there aren't really four seasons. There's winter and summer. That's essentially it. Of course, you know, the transition between those, you know, spring and fall, you know, they exist, but they're not quite as pronounced. They don't, I guess, qualify enough for their own seasons. So Imesh is summer, Intin is winter. Just keep that in mind. So I'm going to go ahead and read that. It shouldn't take too long. But and again, there are a little bit of breakages in this, but it's much clearer than the Eridu Genesis. Excuse me. An lifted his head with pride and brought forth a good day. He laid plans for and spread the population wide. Enlil set his foot upon the earth like a great bull. Enlil, the king of all lands, set his mind to increasing the good day of abundance, to make the night resplendent in celebration, to making flax grow, to making barley proliferate, to guaranteeing the spring floods at the quay, to making lengthen their days in abundance, to making summer close the sluices of heaven, and to making winter guarantee plentiful water at the quay. Now, obviously I said spring floods there, but that is not, again, a concept that the Sumerians said. That's just how it's translated for a period of a very specific period of time. He copulated with the great hills. He gave the mountain its share. He filled its womb with summer and winter, the plentitude and life of the land. As Enlil copulated with the earth, there was a roar like a bull's. The hill spent the day at the place, and at night she opened her loins. She bore summer and winter as smoothly as fine oil. He fed them pure plants on the terraces of the hills like great bulls. He nourished them in the pastures of the hills. Enlil set about determining the destinies of summer and winter. For summer, founding towns and villages, bringing in harvests of plentitude for the great mountain Enlil, sending laborers out to the large arable tracts, and working the fields with oxen. For winter, plentitude, the spring floods, the abundance and life of the land, placing grain in the fields and fruitful acres, and gathering in everything, Enlil determined these as the destinies of summer and winter. By hand, winter guided the spring floods, the abundance and life of the land. Down from the edge of the hills, he set his foot upon the Tigris and Euphrates like a big bull and released them into the fields and fruitful acres of Enlil. He shaped lagoons in the water of the sea. He let fish and birds together come into existence by the sea. He surrounded all the reed beds with mature reeds, reed shoots, and reeds. Obviously, we don't know what the third type of reeds were there. Now, this is a section that has been damaged, so it's going to be very short. Summer, the heroic son of Enlil, drained the large arable tracts. He cool water on the fields and fruitful acres like... And that, sadly, is what we have. Holy winter, the ox, its head in the yoke. Ninurta, Enlil's son, the fruitful acres. He, grain in the large arable tracts. He fills the field and fruitful acres of Enlil. Winter made the ewe give birth to the lamb. He gave the kid to the goat. He made cows team together with their calves. He provided butter and milk. On the high plain he made the deer and stag glad of heart. He made the birds of heaven set their nests in the broad spaces. The fish of the lagoons laid eggs in the reed beds. In all the orchids he made honey and wine drip to the ground. He made the trees wherever planted bear fruit. He established gardens and provided plants. He made grain abundant in the furrows. He made Azina appear radiant as a beautiful maiden. The harvest, the great festival Enlil, rose heavenward. Azina is another grain goddess. She's not a specific type of grain or like Sud, the grain as it's getting ready to, or the ripened grain, the fully grown grain. She is just the goddess of grain. And she also appears in a disputation literature, which we'll probably go over at some point. Now, we'll continue. Excuse me. Summer founded houses and farmsteads. He made the cattle pens and sheepfolds wide. He multiplied the sacks of sheaves and all the arable tracks. At their edges he made flax ripen. He brought a plentiful harvest into the temples. He heaped up piles of grain. He founded towns and villages. He built the houses of the land. He made the houses of the gods grow like the hills in a pure place. In Amnamtala, the holy seat of kingship, fit for high daisies, he established abundance for the great mountain Enlil. Summer, the heroic son of Enlil, deciding to bring offerings to Amnamtala, the house of Enlil, he brought animals, cattle, and sheep of the hill, fully grown, wild rams, deer, and stags, sheep, long-fleeced, barley-fed sheep, thick-tailed sheep, pigs grown fat in the midst of the reed beds, porcupine, tortoise, turtle, birds brooding in their nests, taken together with their eggs, harvest crops, flour and malt for mixing, butter and milk from cattle pen and sheep fold, wheat, beans, small beans, large beans, gathered and piled high baskets, onions in their furrows, zahadin, onions and shallots, seeds, turnips, saffron, and then there are 8 lines missing. Summer, the heroic son of Enlil, offered. Winter, lordly son of Enlil, released the water of life and opened. He gathered the oxen and the disputed sheep was provided, barley fed, but with a scorpion at its side, quartz, gold, and silver found in leather pouches, cedar, cypress, boxwood, tribute of the land, figs from Mari, strings of dried fruit, cool water, the tribute of the hills, thick honey, Dita beer, village, Bibra birds, Essig birds, Burubakur birds, fattened ducks, carp, which winter made grow up, large pomegranates gathered from the orchards, big bunches of grapes on high water cucumbers, empty, brought forth. In the early rain, large turnips, large, cut down with the knife, long leeks, winter himself brought the tribute he had collected. Summer and winter set about organizing the animals and offerings for Amnamtala, the house of Enlil. The two of them, like huge budding bulls, reared themselves triumphantly. But winter, because his limbs had grown tired from the grain grown heavy in the furrows, and the wheat and the emmer, which he had been watering by hand, turned away as from an enemy and would not draw near. Consequently, winter was overcome by anger, and he started a quarrel with summer. Summer, my brother, you should not praise yourself. Whatever harvest produce you bring as gifts to the palace has not been made by your toil. You should not brag, as if you were the one who had done the hard work, as if you had done the farming, as if you had taken care of irrigation control during the spring floods, as if you had brought forth the grain in the arable tracts with dew from heaven. How much through my toil is it that you enter the palace? whatever animals, cattle and sheep of the hill, you bring to my... And then there's a 11 lines missing. And then a few more fragmentary lines, which I'm going to read now. The breaks are the fragments, as it has been in all of these. Your gardener. The palace. Honey and wine in the orchard. Its destructive hoe. Your gathered vegetables. The purslane. Whatever you. At the gate of the palace, in the field, your arm. The straw of the grain you bring. After you have threshed it at your threshing floor and have the cattle's dung, your carrying nets are to hand. Bearing your straw, the animals, the storehouses, and their contents after your houses and farmsteads. Sheep from your cattle, after their reed beds, after green briars and cut thorns, storehouse, the dung of unyoked oxen, the slave summer, the duly appointed laborer who will never rest from his toil, a hired man who has to return to the fields of the land for his own sustenance. On that day, winter taunted summer. Summer, the hero, whom one does not challenge, searching for rude insults. He was confident in himself, considering the harvest time, and turned aside. Like a great bull eating rich grass, he raised his head. Next, summer replied to winter. Winter, you may have to stay by the side of the oven, but you should not launch such serious insults against someone who does not lead a sedentary life. For the work of tilling the land, with its difficulties, you do not raise a cry in the goon. We don't know what that means. Cult center, you do not look after the house. The young scribe is neglectful, which is an abomination, and no rushes are plucked for the beds. The singer does not embellish the banquet. At its side. Winter, don't launch such insults. To the desert, I will make the strength of my power come forth in the house so that you recognize it. In my working term of duty, which is 7 months of the year, does not speak softly. And then we have some more broken lines. Tirelessly and constantly, I place abundance upon the fields. After they, my seed, winter, do not. Noise. When water is cut off from the arable tracts, when the bowls lie placed, when the fishing place has been prepared, when the fish have piled up, I am Father Enlil's great controller. I harrow the fields into fruitful acres. When the oxen have stopped working the fields, when you have concentrated your efforts on the damp areas and given the sign for the field work, I do not bring for you in the large arable tracts and fruitful acres early in the season. If the spring grain bends its neck in the hollow of the furrows, no one provides a fence. Whatever your farmer brings to the oxen, he will not make the oxen angry with me. Winter in the uplands, the man of the bedroom. Then summer taunted winter. Wise, serious insults, not. Thereupon winter replied to summer. Summer, the donkey grazing on the grass at the harvest ground and braying noisily, the mule, the harvest ox chafing at its neck, it the pegs and tossing its head in the lead rope, the innkeeper going to the harvest ground carrying a bowl in his hands, the flower playing, the bragging field worker who does not know the extent of the field. Summer, my brother, after you have gone out boasting about my toil, when at the turn of the year grain is brought into the houses and the granaries are packed full, when you bring the surplus, your badul garment and your niglam garment are. When someone gives a two mana axe to you, you go off to your step. Summer, my brother, the wet spots must not be. When tilling the field, a man from the storehouse stands in front of you and instructs you. When on the high plain, the ash tree, yourself. And then there's a whole line missing. When tribute is brought in your freight boats, when the grass has arrived in the storehouse before me, what will the pen sheep eat? your reeds are exhausted. The reed cutter who sets about pruning with a machete and splitting older reeds. The builder who places laborers in houses, never resting from his effort. The potter who digs out clay, lights a fire and stokes it with wood. The pot. Weaver, weave your bardel garment with the strength of your octum cloth. Brewer, break your beer bread at the harvest ground as your assignment. Cook, produce great banquet loaves in summer. The building supervisor, the blank of the roofs, people, boots and shoes. Summer, my brother, as long as you go on with my term of duty, great and small, order you about and your sting is not cut. Although you have gathered all things in the land and filled the storehouses, in all my strengths I am their owner. When your limbs become tired, when the clouds have brought down the abundance of heaven, and the water of the first greeting has descended from my hill, from the hills, and the new grain has been put in the granary to be added to the old grain, the good farmer, having seen to his fields, shouts for joy. The carrier donkeys stand ready, and he sets out to confidently for the city. Sorry, throat's getting a little dry there. Excuse me. My brother, when you have put the holy plow away in the barn, the storehouse, everything you have gathered, you make a roar like fire. You sit down to plentiful food and drink. You obtain the choicest goods from the land. For my king named by Nana, the son of Ilil, Ibi Suin, when he is arrayed in the Kutar garment and the Hursaj garment, when you have taken care of the Bardo garment and the Nijlam garment, when you have made a perfect feast for the gods, when the Anuna have placed garments on their holy bodies, in his Enantila, the holy abode of kingship founded by An, at that place of content, they prepare a choice banquet. Excuse me. When the sim and ala drums and other instruments play together for him, he passes the time with your heart-gladdening tiyi and zamzam instruments. But it is I who have made the wine plentiful and made much to eat and drink. I perfect the garments with fine oil. I bring up the kutur and aktum garments as for safeguarding the best in Sumer in the oppressive heat of summer where they had been put away in the bedrooms amongst the black-headed people. Moths destroy the blankets and make the octum cloth perish because of you. Exhaust itself for you. The wooden chest, I am Ninkasi's help. For her, I sweeten the beer with as much cold water, the tribute of the hills, as you brought. And Ninkasi is the goddess of brewing, for those that obviously didn't get the very clear text there. After the plump grapes have been laid out in the cool breeze, I make my king's great palace pleasant. I am the one who cools down my king. I fill the fish hook. My comrade, grasp your leather bag. Go out. The farmer, hardship. The farmer, the rain. The gardener does not know how to plant purslane. Your basket. How can you compare yourself to me while seeking a roof under which to rest? For the second time, winter had taunted summer. Summer, the heroic son of Enlil, was convinced of his own strong power and consequently trusted in himself. He acted as if in a friendly manner to the insults that winter had spoken to him. Then, summer replied to winter. Winter, you should not boast about your superior strength. After you have explained the grounds for your boasting, I shall speak about your abode in the city, which I shall. You seem like a man of office, but you are an inept in one. Your straw bundles are for the oven side, hearth and kiln. Like a herdsman or shepherd, encumbered by sheep and lambs, helpless people run like sheep from overside to kiln and from kiln to oven side. In the face of you, in sunshine, you reach decisions, but now in the city, people's teeth chatter because of you. When the day is half gone, nobody walks about in the streets. The servant, basking by the side of the oven, is in the house until sunset. The maid, not attending to the flow of the water container, passes the day on garments. As for the fields, not worked in winter, their furrows were not cut straight, and their grain, having not been cast into a wholesome place, is taken away by a huge flock of rooks. The vegetable cutter does not. Those vegetables at the market. Carrying old reeds, the laborer is halt and lame. Don't speak with a gaping mouth of your superior strength. I will make known its shape and essence. For a second time, summer had taunted winter. On the day of the Ecor's festival and summer's plenty, the two of them stretched their legs and stood combatively, summer and winter, like great bulls about to tear each other's horns, bit forward like wild bulls in the main courtyard, and took up their positions. Like a great bull, winter raised his head to speak. Father Enlil, you gave me control of irrigation. You brought plentiful water. I made one meadow adjacent to another, and I heaped high the granaries. The grain became thick in the furrows. Izina came forth in splendor like a beautiful maiden. Summer, a bragging field administrator, who does not know the extent of the field? My thighs are grown tired from toil. Tribute has been produced for the king's palace. Winter admires the heart of yore in words. Summer pondered everything in his head and calmed down. Summer spoke respectfully to Enlil. Enlil, your verdict is highly valued. Your holy word is an exalted word. The verdict you pronounce is one which cannot be altered. Who can change it? There was quarreling of brother with brother, but now there is harmony. For as long as you are occupying the palace, the people will express all. When it is your season, far be it from me to humiliate you. In fact, I shall praise you. Enlil answered Summer and Winter. Winter is controller of the life-giving waters of all the lands. The farmer of gods produces everything. Summer, my son, how can you compare yourself to your brother Winter? The import of the exalted word Enlil speaks is artfully wrought. The verdict he pronounces, is one which cannot be altered. Who can change it? Summer bowed to Winter and offered him a prayer. In his house he prepared emmer beer and wine. At its side they spend the day at a succulent banquet. Summer presents Winter with gold, silver, and lapis lazuli. They pour out brotherhood and friendship like best oil. By bringing sweet words to the quarrel, they have achieved harmony with each other. In the dispute between Summer and Winter, Winter, the faithful farmer of Enlil, was superior to Summer. Praise be to the great mountain, Father Enlil. And there you go. That is obviously a very straightforward example of the disputation literature that I laid out a couple of weeks ago. This is my favorite one, honestly, but there are a couple of others that, you know, we'll go over probably later. But going back and trying to just think of connections to, like, more, you know, familiar literature to a modern person, with the comparison of the Eridogenesis to, of course, the Genesis in the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament, when I first was reading this, I thought, is this going to be a Cain and Abel type situation? Was that also influenced? And not really. I mean, brothers fight, and that's kind of apparent that this is something that, you know, your average Sumerian would understand. Yeah, brothers fight, and that's even mentioned in the text. It's more, you know, just kind of laying out why one season is better than the other, but it also lays out what's important to get done in each season. Obviously, you have to maintain a balance, just like it says there. They have achieved harmony with each other. So, you know, this is something of a morality tale, but also something of an educational tool. This was probably taught to students. Scribes would be transcribing this. And, you know, this would be kind of a way to teach younger scribes, you know, part of what needs to be done each season. And it also talks about, you know, lazy scribes and, you know, how lazy servants try to get by at certain periods. So there's some admonishment again in there. But yeah, so it's a mix of several things, but it also involves some prey poetry for Enlil. You got to make sure Enlil's recognized as the great god, the creator god. He created the seasons as the Sumerians understood them. And those seasons themselves served Enlil by doing all this great stuff. And humans have to serve Enlil the same way. They have to serve the gods the same way. And they have to work the same way as the gods do. They have to do these various tasks in winter and summer. Depending on, of course, what your job was, you would have different roles at different times. But, of course, that, yeah, that's common sense, obviously. But yeah, so long episode this week, probably the longest one I've done in a while, although the one last week was almost as long before I lost it, but yeah, thankfully no big issues yet. Of course, I'm going to be holding my breath as I export this and get it saved, but thank you all for joining me this week. Just a reminder, there will not be an episode next week. I am going on a nice week-long vacation with some friends. Sorry, but you know, maybe when we come back, we'll have another nice long episode. I'm not sure when that next episode is going to be. I doubt it will be the Monday following my return, which again, I'm gone from this weekend to next. I will be back home that Sunday, which is when I normally record, but I don't know that I'll be able to prepare enough material and notes to actually record an episode. I might have some time to get one out maybe Monday afternoon or maybe middle of the week before I leave for Thanksgiving, but we'll just have to see. Worst case scenario, we'll be returning at the last Monday of the month. But thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed my dramatic reading of those works. If you have any questions or comments, or if I missed anything in explaining what something was, please let me know. And if you, again, if you have any constructive criticism, comments, questions, feedback, you can reach me via email at waratrevpod.com, or excuse me, waratrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter, or you can comment on any of my YouTube videos. I may not respond immediately there, but I will respond. And I will occasionally go back on old comments if YouTube notifies me that someone's made a comment. I had someone provide some feedback from an episode from last year. I will see it eventually. But thank you all, and I hope you all have a good rest of your day and rest of your week. Take it easy. Peace.